8, 6, 1, 0.
Welcome to the Radio Art Hour, a show where art is not just on the radio, but is the radio.
Oh, radio, radio. Uh-huh. Radio.
The Radio Art Hour draws from the Wavefarm Broadcast Radio Art Archive, an online resource that aims to identify, coalesce, and celebrate historical and contemporary international radio artworks made by artists around the world. Created specifically for terrestrial AM/FM broadcast, whether it be by commercial, public, community, or independent transmission. Come on a journey with us as radio artists explore broadcast radio space through poetic resuscitations and playful celebrations, subversions of the complex relationship between senders and receivers in this hour of radio about radio. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the Radio Art Hour and Wavefarm's Radio Art Archives.
I'm Tom Rowe at the Wave Farm in upstate New York, where we work with artists that work with the radio waves. And recently, two of the Wave Farm Radio Artist Fellows, Karen Werner and Jess Speer, have been collecting all sorts of radio artworks that we're gathering here in the Radio Art Hour to feature with other works and backed by the Conant Project's Number Station recordings, which you hear behind us now.
This is Karen Werner, and I'm excited to share a piece with you from the Wave Farm Radio Art Archive, Ligature, by American radio artist Joan Schumann, produced in 2009. Listening to a number of Joan Schumann's pieces, I'm struck by the sensuality and dreamy surrealism of her work. She combines documentary poetics with a radio drama and radio poem. Ligature is loosely based on the lives of Daisy and Violet Hilton, conjoined twins born in the UK in 1911. They were part of the European circus and sideshow circuit in the 1920s and 30s. Joan Schumann writes, quote, "They're retired now. They whisper themselves to sleep while conjuring what death will feel like when it comes to them both. Their single knotted torso extends beyond immediate relationship out to the world." Quote, Ligature is part of a pair of pieces called Catalog of Mourning, as in grief, and is 19 minutes long.
Are you awake, beloved sister? Are you awake, beloved sister? All we have to do is talk on the sea like a dream. Daisy. Are you awake?
Look at it. It wraps us like a rope away. A satin soft bell. Not a taffeta sash merely swirling around us with faint. Pull on it, it's taut, yet yielding. Everybody wants to see how much they can stretch it. But we've been practicing stretching with our breath, not against it, not restrained by it, dear sister. If we oil and massage this bridge of tissue, it's beginning to become supple. It's a mere sheath surrounding capillaries, that's all it is. Networks connecting the whooshing blood, our shared blood. This single knotted torso is all we know. It's all I know. Saying we is like uttering I. It's foolish to try to distinguish or parse the two. So why do I whisper when you and I are intertwined? Violet. Daisy. I can hear your soft inhalations, your softer exhalations. I can almost feel your eyes fluttering beneath their lids. So why do I whisper?
Don't.
If all I have to do is gently shift my weight, my half of the weight,
wake them,
caress your legs with mine, wrap my arms around you. Why do I fear a bending end, dear sister? Dearest Daisy,
Violet.
When I'm lucky enough to
Violet.
Follow one so close with my eyes to admire you always.
Daisy.
Most people don't
Daisy.
Have this kind of bond.
Daisy.
I guess they say we're too close.
Are you awake?
But to have such an other is to know in a more intense way. Yes, already injured, always insistent, more unforgettable. One of us will inevitably witness the other's death. We'll feel the blood, even. We'll see the ashen, ghostly skin replace the familiar pink hue. That pink hue I see every day. Dear sister, I didn't mean to wake you. You're awake.
Daisy.
I always relish your whispers in my ear, your warm lips, your soft breath signaling. Signaling I'll never be alone. Here, let's...
I'm awake.
Flapping in and upper out of the lagoon, dunking their pointy heads feverishly in the water. Sometimes their manic bathing seems all in unison. Yes, and sometimes it's this quiet cacophony. I adore their bellies, with their thin white feathers stretched to cover such plump roundness as they skittle along the surf's edge, barely touching the ground. Is that a snowy plover we saw? Yesterday. Maybe it was a killdeer. I love that bird, his name, how it sings. We should take the binoculars tomorrow. Yes, and the bird book. were knotted together with this taut rope, this umbilicus. Never asked you this, dear Daisy. Do you begrudge Mama? It was she who begged the midwife not to utter a word, not to loosen a gasp after the last of our legs were delivered. They say they tried untangling our arms, but we just held on. They cupped our soft skulls. Those fontanelles might break. They were so worried. The inevitable comparison to eggs in a basket. I don't begrudge her. I don't begrudge her that she relinquished her hold on us. I think Mama was brave. She secretly gave us each a breast to nourish when they told her not to. They told her that we should not be fed. It was she who nearly died, and she gave us life. She had no choice. Whose brazen but broken sea connected us eternally? She would never say. It was she who was ravaged by God's anger. Mama's the one that bore the weight of the devil's influence. She had no choice but to deliver us into the hands of that tyrant, that evil woman. Evil woman who held us so long.
Cutting the cords.
I'm so glad we're free.
But not the one that bound us, even though the doctors tried to convince her to cut us.
Daisy. No, this single knotted torso of ours, dear sister. I'm glad for it, dear sister. I wonder where. Swooning fans. I was just thinking about all those special dresses they made for us. Those flashing bulbs. They accentuated our sash. They put satin over us and pearls and lace. You even adorned it with trinkets and charms. Remember that? That was lovely when you did that.
Some days.
They were beautiful. All those eyes ogling us. Those grubby hands wanting to grab our bond.
Wanting to be beautiful.
You still are beautiful.
Sash of skin.
But when we were on tour,
we were adept circus freaks.
Our talents sparkled. Quite adept. It was great dancing with you, but I suppose no bow could ever really be expected to cut in to whisk one of us away and twirl around on the dance floor.
Daisy.
But I'm so glad for a quiet life now. Now we just wait for the
Violet.
Daisy.
Violet.
Can anyone dispassionately walk by those beautiful carcasses, whispering the edge of the sea, the amazing color by the throat, white tips on the secondaries? How can anyone walk by and not wonder how they got there? Those gorgeous creatures were dragged by vultures. It's only natural to be left entangled in the eel grass. Hidden in the driftwood. You might lie there motionless for months and months and months. What good does it do knowing that they're there? Or wondering how they died? But Violet, the
scientists have to know. They collect all the data. Daisy.
Daisy, does knowing how their lives ended change anything?
Everything dies. There's even a beauty in death. You said so yourself.
Violet, we might be destroying their precious sea. Soon the water will be too warm for them to even feed their babies.
Oh, Daisy. What good does it do us knowing that they're there? We're wondering how they died.
Think the law of friendship is when you have a bond such as ours? And what do you think the law of mourning is?
Well, Daisy, one must always go before the other. We know that.
One must always die first. And in our case, it's going to be right in front of the other's eyes. We've known this from the beginning. Most people, even if they die together, their link will have been sutured from the beginning by the possibility that one would see the other die. So surviving would be left to bury, to commemorate, to mourn, but we're not going to have that.
No. Dear sister, I'm glad for it.
Dear sister, I'm glad. This posthumous infidelity that exists from the beginning of friendship, from the beginning, from our beginning. To watch me die? Maybe minutes or succumbing hours later? I would become this dying flesh still attached to you.
Daisy, you aren't just flesh next to mine, dear sister. We are one. How many times do I have to tell you this?
You're being unfair. As we came into the world together, so we'll leave it together. Remember.
I do. I think of them often, Violet.
Are they really like us? Some of them. Some of them lived much less time.
Yes, but the Bidden twins, remember? After Eliza died, they say Mary refused the doctor's attempts at slicing her. Slicing that lost twin. Not even for an hour. And Mary, she was dead. She was dead within the hour.
They honor us in the same way they honored those righteous women.
It would be wonderful if they did.
They could make biscuits with our pictures, with our image emblazoned on it, and dole them out to the poor on Easter Sunday. That would be fitting. I suppose.
I so often hear people say what the dead would have wanted. I think they just don't understand, or they want to believe. It's just absurd. To go on speaking of this all alone after the death of the other. To conjecture.
The least conjecture.
To risk.
The least interpretation.
Feels to me like an endless insult.
Endless insult or a wound. And maybe the duty towards the dead.
Violet, are you saying we shouldn't conjecture what the other would want after she passes? It might just be a few minutes or a few hours. I have always wondered what you would want, but then I always knew I'd follow you, and quickly. So the absurdity is mostly with the rest of the world, with those who aren't gnarled and knotted together. They don't know. It's they who risk. They who conjecture. They who think they'll have this span of time without the other from which to mourn. Yes, all the world's as awful as I am. They don't know. They should stop predicting. They should stop predicting and waiting for that long chasm between the one's death and their own. Our photos are ready. Ready for the grave. Specters smiling down at each other. The only thing there'll be an end to is our subtle voicing. Though it's never been both. I won't have to visit you. I'll be lying there right next to you, embraced as we do in sleep each night. A gentle tug of the hips urges
Violet
to adjust.
When did we materialize this enormous morning?
Knowing the removal of a limb and her whole being to be the silence, the absence. The paths opened up off all the beaten tracks that deported memory. Morning, every possible morning. You will leave me inevitably, Daisy. But I will not survive you. I will not survive without
this single
you.
Knotted torso of ours
is all we know. Yes, Daisy. What does it mean that all those puffins and auklets washed up dead on the beach last year? I don't know. I don't know, dear Daisy. Good night.
You just heard Ligature by Joan Schumann. To learn more about Joan Schumann's radio art and her curatorial project, Earlid, please visit the Wave Farm Radio Art Archive at wavefarm.org.
I'm Jess Beer for the Wave Farm Radio Art Archive, and I'm pleased to introduce North Country, a 1995 piece by a central figure in the American radio art field, Helen Thorington. Playing on themes of memory, time, hypertextuality, and principles of storytelling, the piece includes dreamlike interludes and repeated phrases and images that give the sense that we are skipping not only from one story to another, but between layers of a story, told several times over in several different media and perspectives. Let's hear it now.
North Elba, New York, July 1993. The skeletal remains, believed to be that of an adult female between the ages of 37 and 47, were discovered by a couple fishing in a small lake off Route 73 near the town of North Elba. The skull had a gunshot wound in its right side. Additional bones and the remains of clothing, including jeans, work boots, a shirt, sweater, and a leather jacket, were also found. In spite of the grisly scene, suicide, not murder, is the suspected cause of death.
likelihood the bullet damaged the hippocampus. Had she lived, she would no longer have had the ability to form memories. The investigation revealed numerous signs of animal activity in the area. The lower portion of the skeleton was missing, and while the upper part, including the skull, was relatively complete, the heads of a number of the bones, including those of the long humeri and ulnae from the arms, had been bitten off post-mortem. The remains of the victim's jeans, shirt, and jacket were found near the bones. The bones and other evidence were carefully gathered up by the investigators. They were brought in and turned over to myself as the region's deputy chief medical examiner at exactly 2 p.m. An hour after the police brought them in, I removed the remains from the carton and systematically laid them out on a tabletop in my office. The reassembly process began with the skull.
Who is she? Who is she?
Simon says, please tell the story from the beginning. Go back, all the way back.
She goes back as far as she can. She thinks of astronomical space. She thinks of the picture she has seen of matter propelled forward by the hypothetical explosion known as the Big Bang. Great chunks of spherical material moving toward her from some distant point, some earlier moment.
It's always difficult to find the beginning. Or better, it's difficult to begin at the beginning and not try to go further back.
Her eyes travel quickly over the quiet, undisturbed waters of the lake, noting the perfect reflection of the shoreline, the ruler straight cut of the hemlock's lower branches, a line etched into the woodland by hungry deer, their sharp teeth imposing a shape and orderliness seemingly of human origin on the entangled wildness and desolation of the northern shore. And there, where the shoreline bends, standing straight and tall against the fir as it had for years, the silvery, ghost-like remains of a tamarack. Her eyes linger in admiration on the intricate filigree patterns it casts onto the lake's imaging surface. Glacial terrain, they had said. In the distance, beyond the hill called Forgotten Hill, skeletons of old mountains stand, a billion years old. And here, at the lake's margin, the same ice age terrain, a soil so rocky, a sudden wind might tip and upend the trees, their roots unable to penetrate deeply enough to secure themselves against the sudden heaving of the earth or the accidental play of violent winds. Close to where she stands, a 30-foot fir tilts to one side. Its gnarled roots spread out across the surface of an erratic boulder. Looking for all the world like the arms of a giant squid, she thinks, and raises her arms playfully in a gesture of mock menace. A giant squid, An Architeuthis. Architeuthis, where did that come from? She knows nothing about squid, and her Latin all but disappeared over 40 years before. Veni, vidi, she says. I came, I saw. She can't remember the third word. She guides the canoe slowly across the lake, her eyes searching for something. She's not sure what. A sign, perhaps. Something that will give direction to her movements. She sees nothing. And that, she realizes, is the point. She settles on the wildest stretch of shoreline, a place without pathways, a wilderness in which it makes sense to strike out in any direction, and with strong, quick strokes, paddles toward it. She beaches the canoe on the far side of a tangled mass of dead and broken trees in an area dominated by reeds and grasses where it will not be seen from the water. Then, putting the pack on her shoulders, she moves quickly into the wet wilderness.
Science isn't simply a matter of collecting facts. It's about arranging them as well. You build a structure of inferences. You snap them together piece by piece. The arrangement is everything. Think of scientific theory as a mental construct that helps you organize data in a useful way. It's a convenient fiction.
Something snaps into place. Vicky, she shouts. I conquer. That's it. No wonder I couldn't remember.
Who is she?
Three hours later, a middle-aged woman enters her new office. Seating herself at the desk, she stares at the terminal's blank window, straining for understanding. How is it possible for someone to disappear and never be missed? How is it possible that no one ever inquired for this woman? Not one person in 3 years. For a time, the questions repeat themselves. Not one.
How is it possible?
Not one.
How is it possible?
Not one.
How is it possible? Not one.
Then gradually they fade, absorbed into the immense, inarticulate underside of her own life.
Who is she?
Their second life. We cannot determine the exact moment when the self under another form goes on with the task of existence.
The concept of person is not a concept that stands still.
I can't believe it. The eastern wood rat is disappearing. There are only 11 left, and you know what? Nobody knows why.
She returns to an awareness of her surroundings, reaches for the terminal switch, and pushing one of a number of nearby cartridges into the port, turns on the machine. Within minutes, she is paddling the cold, choppy waters of a northern lake. Text. It is midsummer. The skies are clear, and the sun's rays strike with a blinding brightness. The wind is blowing, and the day is icy cold. The coldest winds blow from the mountains to the north, where ice still covers the peaks. She wraps her legs in woolen leggings in anticipation of the cold, and pulls a deerskin jacket over her sweater. Still, in spite of the cold, her palms grow sweaty as she approaches the shore, and wet patches spread out under her arms. She tries to remember that this is a game, like many she has played before, and that in all likelihood, she will accumulate bonus lives before she is through. But she knows it is not like other games. It is drawing her in, taking possession of her, affirming its own reality through her. She experiences a twinge of near terror at the thought that her life is not under her control. Then, as her eyes continue to probe the shoreline, trying to catch a glimpse of any unusual movement, she forgets her fear and finds herself wondering how she came by this amazingly natural skill with a canoe, this alertness to her environment, this sense of connection to the water, the air, the land toward which she moves. The stillness of the shore is uncanny. Where she is, the wind blows, a sharp, cold breath requiring both strength and attention to navigate the small craft, to keep it moving in one direction. On the shore, nothing seems to move. She fixes on the tops of the tallest trees. There is no wind. On the water, close to shore, it's like glass. The skeleton of an ancient tamarack throws intricately embroidered patterns onto its mirror-like surface, reminding her of something.
Everything is a secret mirror of something else, Simon says.
Wrong! Thomas De Quincey said it!
Frankly, I astonish myself. 40 years out of college, my education all but forgotten, and I remember Thomas De Quincey. Who am I?
And then it happens. The shoreline begins to waver and shift. The trees no longer stand straight, but bend first in one direction, then another, like an image breakup on a screen. Details blur and fade, images disappear, while between and around, a gray space enlarges, grows enormous, and a terrifying emptiness fills her vision.
It's always unsettling to think what we might be missing, but mind and memory tend to organize experience in their own way.
Simon says, tell the story from the beginning.
The facts, damn it, just give me the facts.
The case becomes one more folder in the file of unsolved crimes.
Thank you.
The screen is blank. The terminal off. She stares at it, puzzled by its presence so close to her face, troubled by the experience of disillusion and emptiness that envelops her. Outside, a northeasterly wind begins to blow. The temperature falls. In the morning, she rises early before dawn and begins the 20-mile drive to her office. The road is slippery, and to her surprise, it curves more than she remembers. But then, she is not that familiar with the drive, and the slick surface requires her focused attention. Later, she will remember with some curiosity the intensity of the experience, and a few set pieces. The hypnotic tick of the windshield wipers, a picture of herself hunched forward, straining to see the road. She wonders if she has confused the materials of this new memory with old memories of movies. One scene seems unique. She is passing through a particularly dark, wooded area when she slows to consider which of two branching roads to take. The one to the left has the force of a magnet, drawing her irresistibly toward it. But the road's surface is like glass, reflecting the lights, the front of the car, her own huddled image, while over the right-hand fork a white mist lifts, revealing the solidity of wet asphalt. At the last minute, she brakes, the car sliding sideways for 10 or 12 feet before she can bring it under control and return to the right fork. She had been frightened, she remembers, by the thought of navigating a space that reflected back her own image. By evening, memory of the road's location has faded. She suspects it may be somewhere 8 to 10 miles from home, perhaps where the hand-painted sign reads Fibo or Elbow, but its location no longer seems important.
Look, I'm only interested in ascertaining the facts. The facts. Just one little fact.
So tie a yellow ribbon round the whole crime scene. The whole crime scene.
The snow begins Sunday evening. By early Monday, 12 inches have fallen. School is canceled. Without it, the plows will take their time. They will probably not reach her road before noon. She lies in bed, comfortable with the fact that she is not going anywhere. North Elba. The words break through the wash of vague, comfortable, dreamlike thoughts, stunning her with their significance. The sign said Elba, probably North Elba. Abruptly, she sits up. Text. The cold has deepened. The snow, once confined to the peak of the distant mountain, now extends well below the frost line. The wind is bitter. As your canoe approaches the northern shore, brushing through the pale dead weeds, you can hear the sound of thin ice breaking. There is a partially submerged canoe near a mass of dead and broken trees. Beyond the swampy land stretches east and west, blackened and limbless trees rising up out of the partially frozen waters. A cold white mist hovers over the apparent desolation.
D.
Decomposition follows a predictable course. The muscles and ligaments gradually decompose to the point that when a skeleton is picked up or otherwise disturbed, it falls apart. After 2 years, there's no soft tissue left. The bones are completely isolated.
She guides her canoe carefully past the blackened trees. She listens attentively to the sound of breaking ice and the thump and scratch of the dead limbs hovering just beneath the surface. The canoe comes to rest 20 feet from solid land, stuck in the decay of once dead woodland. She sloshes through the partially frozen water. Dead grasses and foot-deep mulch catch at her feet. Inside her waders, her legs and feet grow cold. When she looks back toward the canoe, she can see her pathway through the broken mirror of ice.
All we need is the truth. The truth.
She changes from waders to a pair of lined boots, and with her rucksack slung over one shoulder, surveys the woods. Daylong sun has warmed the pine boughs. Now and then, the branches bend, and their burden of snow falls to the ground, startling her. There is no other sound. Suddenly she stops. There are unexplained words in her head. They come in a voice younger, but otherwise very like her own. For the listener who listens in the snow. She says them to herself, for the listener who listens in the snow. Remembering them as if they were friends, but unable to put them or the voice into a context. She feels the breath of the empty space, the cold, the night closing in.
In general, a body left exposed to the elements in winter will decay more quickly from within. The surface larval activity that can consume the skin in summer, that won't exist. In hot weather, maggots will typically strip a body to the bone in 2 weeks.
When the medical examination is complete, the information gathered is sent to the National Crime Information Center database. Her identity is unknown.
Text. You can no longer remember your step-by-step passage to this spot. You feel as if there has been a jump. Some oddly incomprehensible transition. Information is missing.
It's the gun.
Looking for the cause of forgetting is like looking for the cause of darkness on a moonless night. Instead of asking what happened to cause the darkness, we must wonder why there is no moon. Instead of asking what happened to cause forgetting, we must look for what would have caused remembering had it not been absent.
What would have caused remembering?
Behind her, the landscape has eroded, Details thinned out. Images disappeared. She does not remember the canoe, or the lake, or the intricate image of the dead tamarack reflected on its surface. The sun slips behind the trees. The cold deepens. She moves closer to the woods, gathers pine cones, sticks, broken limbs while she can still see. The window frames the scene in unnatural silence. She continues to stare into the fading light at a woman building a fire, but now she is aware of being cut off from her. The sounds she hears are not those of a wilderness setting, but of a domestic one. They belong to a here in which a refrigerator has just begun to hum. She searches her bedside table for a map, locates North Elba, and traces the small winding road that leads to the dark backward of time. She is upset by the words she had intended to say to the road on which I live.
Is there a difference?
Difference?
Text. The snow has obliterated all the boundaries by which your world is generally defined. You can no longer see the terrain or the pathways that have given you direction. You may stay where you are, or you may strike out in any direction.
Gorillas and chimps living in a well-maintained environment tend to remain there. If you leave the door to their enclosures open, most will watch the open door for a while, then walk over and take a hesitant look outside, then 95% of them will close the door.
She stretches, jumps from one foot to another, beats her chest and arms for warmth. The snow extends pure and unmarked to the horizon. Its beauty in the early morning light as dazzling as anything she can remember. A feeling like intoxication begins to flood her limbs.
It's the gun. It stopped firing.
Remembering transforms one kind of experience into another. In being remembered, an experience becomes a different kind of experience. It becomes a memory, with all that entails, not merely of the consistent, or the enduring, or the reliable, but also of the fragile, the errant, the confabulated.
You've been listening to North Country, written and produced by Helen Thorington. The sound score was composed by Helen Thorington with Guy Klukchevik accordion and Elise Kermani voice. The narrator is Jane Altman. Other voices, Dan Hagen, Regina Beyer, Peter Fernandez, Andrew Jaffe, Bill Morlock, Jerry LaRosa, and Helen Thorington. North Country is a commission of the 1994-95 Radio Consortium, New Radio and Performing Arts in Staten Island, New York, KOHM-FM in Lubbock, Texas, and KGNU-FM in Boulder, Colorado. The commission was made possible with a grant from the Meet the Composer Reader's Digest Commissioning Program in partnership with the National Endowment for the Arts and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, and with additional funds from the New York State Council on the Arts.
You just heard North Country by writer, radio, and net artist Helen Thorington. For more information about the artist and this piece, visit the Radio Art Archive at wavefarm.org.
That was the Radio Art Hour, mostly put together from the work of Wave Farm Radio Art Fellows Jess Speer and Karen Werner. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the radio art you heard featured on the Radio Art Hour.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.